no one else was going to have Holly. If she didn't want to be with him, then no one else was going to be with her.
I saw two people coming down the drive. I knew at that stage something had happened to Holly.
When Holly ended her relationship with Asher Maslin, she thought she had finally escaped the grip of a terrifying and violent bully. She was wrong. On Tuesday, the 18th of February, 2014, Asher came for revenge.
He knew that the salon at that time of night would be relatively empty. He came in, and as soon as he came in, the manager ran to the back of the salon and phoned the police straight away. And then grabbed her with his left arm.
It was a case of, if he can't have her, no one else will.
Holly had been stabbed. She was badly injured and lying on the floor. Maslin ran off into the night, leaving a scene of devastation in the salon. Panic ensued as Holly's colleagues and clients desperately tried to save her life. There was nothing that could be done to save her.
How to bear the unbearable loss of a daughter.
Holly was bright, she was bubbly, she had a massive smile, and people say that when she went into a room, she lit the room up.
Holly Gazzard was just 19. From the very beginning of her relationship with Asher Maslin, her family had misgivings. He'd turn up drunk to a family meal, put her down in front of them, but they had no idea of the extent of his control.
Holly never had a bruise on her. You know, so it was generally the financial and emotional abuse for Holly. I remember Holly waking up to, I think it was 60 missed calls she had once. We tried to protect her as much as we could, but with Holly, if you did too much of that, we would have pushed her away.
The control escalated. When she finally tried to break it off, Maslin stabbed her 14 times in the salon where she worked. The warning signs of endless control and mind games had all been there. A damning report into the police handling of the case was a wake-up call.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds and for Brave New Films.
Well, Laura, we have unfortunately had to move forward these past few weeks with you being very busy, doing very important work. Now we're going to let you tell our listeners exactly what you've been doing.
Yes, and I'm so happy we could just jump on and talk about this because it's very time critical. And why it's time critical is because the domestic abuse bill is going through Parliament at the moment. It's in the committee stage going through the House of Commons, and this stage will complete on June the 25th. And I'll explain a little bit of what that means. But right. Effectively, within the domestic abuse bill, I now have an amendment tabled. It was tabled just this week, Amendment 49, to ensure that there is proactive identification, assessment, and management of serial and serious domestic violence offenders and stalkers. And the reason why that's important is because currently it's not happening. Currently, men are abusing, and I'm saying men in particular here because this is where the lethality connects male violence and the victims are disproportionately female. Is that across my 25 years, I've been involved with reviewing, analysing, tracking these cases and violent men. And currently we know that at least three women are murdered every 2 weeks. And during lockdown, we've had five women murdered a week, and that these aren't first-time offenders. And if I give you another context, we know that only 1% of perpetrators receive an intervention. What I've basically been seeing across my 25 years is that people keep getting away with it. Men are getting away with it. And that's what this amendment is about, to ensure that those who are serial and serious are identified proactively, and that this is a statutory requirement and it's national, i.e. it's core business.
And Laura, can we just go through that statistic again? So you're saying that before lockdown, three women were killed in the UK every 2 weeks. Now, five women are killed every week.
Yes, that's exactly right, Jim. And just to give the context, it's three women are murdered by male partners or ex-partners, and it's five women murdered by male partners and ex-partners each week since lockdown began. And I've been counting those cases and putting them on a spreadsheet since lockdown began.
And that is tripling the murder rate, tripling. That is not an insignificant jump. That's ridiculous. And then when you said the other statistic, only 1% of perpetrators receive an intervention. Can you please explain what that means? Do you mean that people are actually calling in, making complaints against these guys, and only 1% of them, there's actually some kind of intervention on the part of the government, the justice system, law enforcement?
That's right. And it's really confounding in the sense that, for example, if a perpetrator has abused three women, five women, or 18 women, he's no less likely to go to prison or receive an intervention or be tracked than if it were one woman. Now, that's a big problem. And if you just think about that, of any other crime type. So when I first worked at New Scotland Yard, I remember sitting in the intelligence branch and listening to a couple of the detectives who were talking about intelligence, and they were talking about prominent nominals, i.e. people who repeat, and prominent nominals for burglary, for robbery, for motor vehicle crime, and the fact that we as an intelligence branch should know who those repeat offenders were. So, and New Scotland Yard and all law enforcement agencies all across the world, that's their bread and butter. And so my question, even when I was a junior criminal behavioural analyst, and my role was sexual offences, working in the sexual offences section, was obviously we need to do the same when it comes to sex crimes. And then when I thought about domestic violence, I knew that we weren't doing it. I mean, that was in 1996, Jim and Lisa. And I wrote a report in 2001, which was published internally and externally to the Metropolitan Police Service in 2004. And it was called, rather aptly, Getting Away With It, A Profile of the Domestic Violence Sexual Offenders and Serious Offender Analysis. And I made the recommendation that this must happen for domestic violence offenders and stalkers, because we know that rarely are domestic violence or stalking one-off behaviours. We know that they're patterned repeat crimes. And in fact, domestic homicides and stalking homicides are the most predictable and preventable of all cases. And this is because it's a patterned type of behaviour. And it's 2020, and it's just still not happening.
A word that jumped out at me in your amendment is the word proactive.
That's the one, Lisa Z. That's the one.
Even I caught that one. Tell me what that means to you. What does that look like to you in practical terms?
Well, firstly, just to circle back to me saying about prominent nominals and burglary and robbery, and because in the police, we always knew that, for example, with burglary, there was always a high rate of repeat victimization, RV, because normally someone gets burgled, they then kit their house back up with the things that were stolen, and then the burglars go back in again and nick it all.
Right.
So repeat victimization was always thought to be around burglary. And we did initiatives like Operation Bumblebee. And I say we, I didn't, because my specialism was sex crimes. But that was the mentality then. And it stayed with me as a junior. So I was thinking, right, proactive identification, task force approach. Why aren't we doing this with domestic violence and sex crimes? So, and it has to be proactive rather than what we're doing now, which is reactive nothing, not doing anything. We shut the stable door after the horse has bolted and we do a domestic homicide review and we say, oh yeah, look at all these risk flags. And these are all the missed opportunities and lessons to be learned, but sadly, they never are. So the proactive aspect is this. Someone reports domestic abuse and or stalking, that drip, drip, drip of behaviour, and questions should be asked using the DASH risk model. And then the police should proactively investigate and secure all of the evidence. And if it's coercive control, they should be looking at Section 76, coercive control. And if there's physical abuse as well, and or stalking, and they should be looking at Home Office Circular 018 of 2012, where then multiple charges should be filed. And it's really key that they collect all evidence and search all intelligence databases and crime report databases. And that includes the Violent and Sexual Offenders Register, Police National Computer, Police National Database, and every relevant database to see what the perpetrator's history is. then they should check all of the history. And in particular, if there are previous convictions or anything around criminal damage, harassment, burglary, interfering with a motor vehicle, then they should check exactly what those crimes relate to. Does it relate to another female, for example? Are they a serial perpetrator? And they're most likely going to be a repeat and serial perpetrator. But right now, that's not happening. And this really should just be basic lines of investigation and inquiry, but it really must be proactive. And it's so important that all allegations made are cross-referenced with each other so that they pick up the pattern. So it's really important that they check all intelligence databases, local and national. And this is really where the Violent and Sexual Offenders Register should be used. That's where extensive and detailed case management history can be added. And it cannot be on Police National Computer or Police National Database, which is the equivalent of what Jim was talking about, NCIS. So it's so important that officers put histories on databases. That includes convictions and or allegations. Now, the history here is important because these were recommendations made from one of our public inquiries, one in particular called the Bichard Inquiry, which related to the abduction and murders of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman. And it was so important just to underline the fact that there was failure to manage the intelligence in this case in particular about the perpetrator, and there was failure to manage and share the information across police services and within police services and also across agencies. So this has been a repeat issue that has come up time and time again. That's why it's important to be proactive. So the proactive of what the mechanics should be are that Julia comes in and reports, or she calls up and she reports that something has happened, let's say X, it might be coercive control, it might be domestic violence, it might be stalking. And then as soon as the officer takes that report, they should think, and they might not recall it in a local borough, that, oh, I've heard that name before, maybe he's done this before or she's a repeat victim, and therefore you should search on the databases to see what the history is. But right now that's just not happening. And it should just be a matter of routine.
Right. It is in every other aspect of law enforcement.
Exactly, Jim.
Why do we have NCIS? I mean, NCIS is the database in the United States that lists all the prior crimes that people have committed. And it's there so that anybody in any jurisdiction can look and see if this person that they've come across has actually committed crimes before. It's a way for law enforcement to make sure that the person they're interacting with isn't wanted on a warrant somewhere or hasn't done the same thing multiple times and therefore is at a much greater risk and is a much more offensive offender. It sounds like they're not doing that. And at some point, didn't you do just that, Laura? Didn't you gear up the homicide prevention unit? Didn't you actually head the unit that actually looked at these people that are repeat offenders, that are being violent towards women, and that posed a real grave risk to somebody's life? And didn't you prevent homicides from happening by having that unit in place?
Yes, Jim. In short, yes. And I created with many other professionals a risk assessment tool to change the reactive process to a proactive process, so that when someone reports, you ask questions about risk so that you're trying to understand risk, but also how and where to investigate. And then you're meant to put that intelligence information on the system. And actually the Met at New Scotland Yard, when we were doing this work and leading on it, we had a 58% reduction in domestic homicide year on year for about 13 years. Now, that was 33 people, predominantly women, less dead every year. So, and we also created a process called the RAMP, the Risk Assessment Management Panel, so that we proactively targeted these repeat offenders, high-risk offenders. And we were doing that at New Scotland Yard in 2004, and we led the world on it. And it was fantastic work. Scotland, Police Scotland then took that process as the assistant commissioner who I worked with, Steve House, did it in London. He moved up to Scotland. And so Scotland took it on, and they're having great success. So Scotland actually are doing something because they have one police force now. So that good practice is there. But the problem is, Jim and Lisa, when it's somebody's passion and when it's a committed individual, and you may get the other leaders to sign up to it, but unfortunately, certainly in the UK, when the leader moves on, normally the legacy is dismantled. And that's what happened. The Homicide Prevention Unit was dismantled. The work on proactively identifying serial and serious perpetrators stopped. And the ramps in six boroughs that were put in there and we were going to put them across London, they stopped too. So the big problem that I have is that you can have committed and passionate people who come up with getting round the system to make it work. And for example, we had these also multi-agency public protection meetings that were statutory. And I would normally, you know, buy a DCI, Detective Chief Inspector, a coffee or a beer or a glass of wine to get some of these dangerous people put in there too. But I would have to beg and borrow and owe favours for them to do it. Mm-hmm. Okay, but I could problem solve and I'd make it work. But the problem was that I kept saying, but this should be core business. And so when I left the Met, I became the ACPO violence advisor, the Chief Police Officer's advisor. And we were saying at Chief Constable level, we should be doing this. But then my boss moved on and the whole thing stopped again. And so the new boss that stepped in his place, I was saying to her, this is what we should be doing. And she just decided not to do it. And therefore it was never put in place. And now I'm saying, you know, this is now 20 years on, 19, 20 years on. This must be statutory and it must be national. It must be part of core business that this happens across the country. And it can't be dependent on a police chief being passionate about the subject.
Right.
And, it shouldn't be based on that. It should be that this is core business. And that's important because there are a group of people saying, well, this should be voluntary and we can do it as a third sector, i.e. charity. And I'm saying, no, this is not about leadership. This is about a statutory requirement to make this core business. And if it's important and if it gets measured, then it gets done. And we need to have a database approach as well. So just like sex offenders, you put all the information on a national database that everyone can key into to see that Theodore Johnson has actually killed not one woman, Yvonne Johnson, not two women, Yvonne Bennett, but three women, Angela Best. And each time he served time, well, the first woman that he killed was Yvonne Johnson, his first wife. And he brutally killed her. But in court, he told a story that she nagged him and therefore she deserved it. And the judge actually said that this is manslaughter provocation.
Oh, my God.
And you are the victim. That's what the judge said to him.
Oh, my God.
He got 3 years for it. And so he came out and then he met the next Yvonne. And he did exactly the same to her, only he strangled her as the two-year-old baby slept on the bed.
Because he'd had the reinforcement of that asinine judge.
Right.
To say, yeah, I'm the victim here. I'm entitled to do this. Unbelievable. What did that judge say when he murdered the second woman, the second wife?
Yeah, that's the question, Jim, because there's no accountability for when these things happen. But the judge did describe him as the battered husband. And he didn't just then kill Yvonne Bennett. He also then came out 4 years later and he met another lady called Angela Best. And he struck her repeatedly with a claw hammer and took the dressing gown cord and wound it around her neck and strangled her in 2016. So if anyone's unclear about this, this is a gender bias in the system. This is the misogyny. This was a serial killer, because that's what we would call him, Jim.
Yeah, he
is. Who's been allowed to coercively control and abuse and murder three women. He was allowed to do that.
Yeah. Well, is his sentence so light in that, well, not only the first killing, but certainly the second killing? How is a woman's life only worth, what, did you say 3 years?
4 years.
Because that's what we see repeatedly, Lisa. And that's why I get so angry about these cases is double standard. You know, you're more likely to go to prison for forgery or a theft offense or something that's financially related for a longer sentence than you are for murdering someone. You know, and you remember we talked about Sally Challen, who did kill Richard Challen, and she admitted to that, but she was coercively controlled from the age of 15 to 56. But it was never presented in court. She was a victim because her lawyer told her, don't speak ill of the dead. She was handed a 22-year sentence.
22 years.
Versus 3 years and 4 years.
Yep. And that's not an anomaly. That's not an anomaly. I'm seeing these cases all the time. Talking to other cases, well, Darren Trigg abused and murdered two women, Caroline Devlin and Susan Nicholson. And he had relationships with both of them. And in both cases, there was a history of domestic abuse. Yet Sussex Police failed to take any action after the post-mortems, and they didn't identify any suspicious circumstances. And I know on good authority, two police officers were involved in both of those investigations. So they knew about both situations. They investigated both women, but they did not see the similarities or the fact that Darren Trigg was the common denominator as suspicious. They did not make the link. And an independent police inquiry identified, in inverted commas, missed opportunities.
I cannot help but reflect that had these women all been murdered in terrorist incidents, had these women all died of coronavirus, had these women all died, and I've heard my honourable friend from Normanton, Pontefract and Castleford say this many times, all died at sports events around the year, there would be huge inquiry. The government would stop at nothing had these all been terrorist deaths to enact, and not just this government, any government, to enact policy quickly and effectively. Cobra meetings would be held. If this many people had died of corona, even in that space of time, far, far greater response is made to almost every other epidemic than the epidemic of male violence against women.
This is really confounding. No, it shouldn't be, because as you said, it is based on a lack of respect for the lives of women. And it's something that we've seen throughout our careers. And we're not saying, and we'd never say, that when males are the victims of violence from their partner or anybody else, that it is not just as serious a crime. But what we're saying is the reaction of the system seems to be very clearly in favor of the male, whether they are the offender or the victim, they get better treatment. And so when you see a woman getting 22 years for killing her husband when he has been coercively controlling her, but so the male is the victim in that case, but women, when this asshole kills two women, he gets 3 and 4 years respectively for their murders. And he is able to get out and kill a third time. It's unconscionable and it needs to stop. Why wouldn't you want to have a registry, if you're law enforcement, to be able to know that there's a place you can go to look to see if this is a prior offender? And not just a new one, not something that we're creating so you have to do extra work. Just put it in the main registry. Just put it where every other major crime is listed. Why isn't that something you want to do?
And you know what, Jim? It already exists. It's called VISA, the Violent and Sexual Offenders Register. It wouldn't be creating something new. Right. It already exists. And there's multi-agency public protection meetings that are statutory. They already exist too. Only DV and stalking cases are screened out routinely. And there's a discretion that someone can screen them out. And I want that to change. Yeah. Because this system does already exist. And so for government and any officials that are listening to this, we are not, and I repeat, we are not requesting a separate and new system and register. We are requesting that there's an expansion of the existing Violent and Sexual Offenders Register and multi-agency public protection arrangements, that it's expanded so that domestic violence specialists and stalking specialist services sit around that table with the statutory bodies that are already charged with public protection, and that we make the system work, and that we identify these people, because we will save lives and we'll also save money by streamlining it, by coordinating it, by having a database approach that people can tap into and understand what somebody's history is. And we will prevent people from murdering other women and other crimes.
My name is Zoe Dronfield, and I'm a survivor and campaigner against domestic violence. I've been campaigning for the last 4 years alongside Paladin, the National Stalking Advocacy Service, for a serial stalkers and domestic abusers register. Alongside me has been John Clough, who is the father of murdered daughter Jane Clough, who was actually murdered by a serial offender, and Laura Richards, who is the founder of Paladin. We're calling for the government to actually introduce a stalkers register and domestic abusers register to track and monitor these types of offenders. We currently have the framework available, which is the Sex Offenders Register, so we're not asking for them to reinvent the wheel. This is just about opening out the framework that currently exists. We have a petition online on change.org for Serial Stalkers Register, and if you go on change.org, you can actually sign that petition, which now has over 150,000 signatures. So we currently have a domestic violence and abuse bill going through the Houses of Parliament, and we're calling for the register to be part of that law change. And this is something that Theresa May said that she would personally oversee herself. So I'm calling for the government to make this change now. We've been campaigning for a long time, and we need to save lives. This will save lives.
My name's Len Duvall. I'm the Greenwich and Lewisham London Assembly member. I'm glad that we've passed a motion today calling for the establishment of an abusers register for offenders who've committed domestic violence. This will protect victims but also protect their children.
Having undertaken important consultation with survivors and partner organisations, I can confirm I'm happy to join your call to amend the law to create a register of domestic abusers so that offenders can be tracked and monitored and women protected from dangerous perpetrators.
And Laura, it seems to me that what they're saying is that they basically don't mind silencing victims, that they don't mind putting a gag order on them, that they can be weeded out or vetted out of this process. It actually takes more work to say these particular types of complaints and crimes are not going to be listed. Why aren't all of them? Why isn't every single one of them just naturally listed? It just doesn't make sense.
It's confounding. I mean, it takes a lot more work because inevitably you're going to keep going back to the same, I call them spots and hot people. And therefore it takes up more time and energy. I'll give you another example. Keith Ward murdered Julie Steed and Valerie Middleton. And he met Julie in 1981 where she was working in a pub. Well, he was violent to her and she basically disappeared herself and went into a refuge. But he stalked her and he found her and he persuaded her to start the relationship with him, and she got pregnant. He punched her in the stomach and she went into premature labor. Now, at this time, he was still with his wife whilst he was seeing Julie, and she was pregnant at the same time. And when he next saw Julie, he strangled her and killed her whilst her two children were downstairs. And at court, he presented himself as the victim. So this whole claiming the narrative, that's why I'm so sensitive to it and laser focused on it, because he presented as the victim at court. The jury bought it despite the history of violence. They acquitted him of murder, found him guilty of manslaughter due to provocation, and he was sentenced to 4 years.
Jesus.
So 4 years. Whilst he's on weekend release, he starts seeing a new woman called Valerie. Now, they had an argument. She was in the bath. He beat her to death. He claimed at his trial she provoked him, and the jury convicted him of murder, and her children lost her as the mother. So the same pattern. You see exactly the same thing repeat.
Laura, can you explain, like, once someone is a repeat offender is in this registry, how does that save the next life? Did the police just keep an eye on that person, or what does it actually do? You know, I can see that if a woman who was dating had access to that registry, she could look up if this guy she's dating has a history, but how does it help law enforcement?
Well, the first thing is we already have Clare's Law. So, and I was one of the key people pushing for that. And that came in to give victims the right to ask. So somebody can ask, and it came in off the back of Claire Wood's murder. She was murdered by a man called George Appleton. He had an extensive history of stalking, harassment, and violence to other women. She reported to police. The police didn't tell her. He then brutally murdered her, set her on fire. Her father pushed. to have everyone know about Claire's case, and quite rightly. At the same time, I was pushing as well for the right to know and the right to ask. So that did come in. The problem that we have is that A, it's dependent on a victim asking and knowing that they can ask. B, it's dependent upon the discretion of someone deciding they're going to tell, because the police don't have to. So it's, you might, you may, it's up to you. And C, there's no duty on any police officer to put intelligence or information on that someone's a serial perpetrator. So it falls down straight away. So that I still think needs to be bolstered. Now, in the domestic abuse bill, there is a provision there to put that on a statutory footing, which I think is a good thing. But my rub with it is that we shouldn't just be dependent upon victims about them taking action. It actually should be statutory bodies that should take action. So to your question, with sex offenders, for example, this system is already in place and it already happens. So we're just asking for the same thing to happen to serial domestic violence and serious domestic violence offenders and stalkers. So, for example, there are orders that we have called stalking protection orders, domestic violence protection orders, non-molestation orders, restraining orders. So if you know that an offender falls into, I'm calling it category four, you can potentially give them an order and you can give things that prohibit them from doing certain things, i.e. for a sex offender, one example might be you must not go within X radius of a school. Mm-hmm. Okay. And if you do, you'll be recalled to prison because you're on the register. So if there's any breach. So let's just think about that sex offender. If he goes near a school and he's got that order, and there may be other prohibitions and positive obligations placed on him, at no point does anyone say to the teacher, why did you let the children into the playground? Everyone looks at his behavior. And this is the important culture that I'm trying to change. With domestic violence or stalking, you have those orders already that exist. But when there's a breach, A, they're not enforced. And B, someone will say, well, Lisa, why did you go outside your house? Mm-hmm. Why did you do this, Lisa? If you knew he was out there, they don't think, well, actually, the prohibition or positive obligation is on him.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to change. So, you know, we talked about the GO orders, the domestic violence protection orders. An order can be made for an offender to leave the house for 28 days. And that's what I keep talking about. The duty must be on him or the perpetrator to change, to move. And then you've got a rigorous way of following it up, i.e., it's a criminal offence if you don't do it. You'll be recalled to prison. So the system will work in exactly the same way. If you have an offender that falls into a category, they're either serial, two or more victims, or they're serious. And we've already got the definition of what serious means and serial. And so serial is defined as two or more victims where the perpetrator has been convicted for one domestic violence or stalking related offence, a caution, an acquittal, or where orders exist. And those orders include a domestic violence protection order, a stalking protection order, a restraining order, non-molestation order, criminal behaviour order, or violent offender order. And category four includes those thought to commit serious harm or homicide. Now, serious is defined as a risk which is life-threatening and or traumatic, and from which recovery, whether physical or psychological, can be expected to be difficult or impossible. Now, that's our Home Office definition, and we use it in the DASH risk model as well. Now, when it comes to new orders, and when we think about being proactive, now there are orders that can be used where clear and positive obligations are placed on the perpetrator. And this is just like the risk of harm orders that are used for sex offenders. So the positive obligations might include, for example, they must attend a treatment program, or if they change their name, they must notify the police, or if they move, they must notify the police, or if they travel abroad, they have to notify the police. And this is a very important one. And if they start a new relationship with someone, they must notify the police. But the list isn't exhaustive. There are many other obligations that can be placed on the perpetrator, and this is how you manage their behavior. And it has nothing to do with what the victim's doing. So it's about this current victim, and it's also about future victims that might be at risk. Then they would go into category four of the MAP meeting, or multi-agency public protection arrangement, and it will be a MAP plus. So a group of professionals will sit around the table, they will look at his risk assessment, they will look at the victim as well, And you will have victim representatives there, advocates, who will talk about the victim's needs, risk and safety. But predominantly that body of people, professionals, will look at problem solving the perpetrator. But the sole emphasis and focus will be around his behaviour. And it might be about engaging him. It might be about enforcing. It might be actually, this guy needs to go to prison. But more often than not, it's a combination of things, unless they're really dangerous, where it is actually, we're problem solving it, but this is an arrestable offence. We've got five victims here from different areas. And it's the join up that happens and the communication that happens to problem solve that perpetrator to make an intervention. And the intervention is tailor-made to that specific individual and what's happening. That is not happening in 99% of cases. There's no multi-agency join up and problem solving. Currently, what happens is everyone sits around the table, if they do, and they talk about the victim and they load her up with all the things that she should do. And he goes unsanctioned. And we tell her she needs to do A, B, and C to safeguard her children. And then we tell her off when she doesn't do the things that she's being told. And we still leave him with no responsibility taking, no accountability. And he, if he's the problem, we must focus on him rather than keep asking the victim what they're doing. And if he is offending in, let's say, Manchester, he may well move to Devon and Cornwall, or he may move to Liverpool, but his history won't follow him. And he might not be convicted of anything, because we know we've got a problem with convictions. And I've just explained to you about how some of the sentences are much lesser than what they should be. So it's really about treating these offenders in a very similar way as we would do sex offenders, and the same way as we would do terrorists, where you can put prohibitions on their behavior and you problem solve them and you close them down. But the focus is very much on them, the perpetrator, the person causing harm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It does. But Laura, what about going further and actually attacking the defendant's ability for this, quote, nagging defense? Why don't legislators litigate away the defendant's right to do that? I mean, in the United States, it used to be commonplace for rape victims to have to sit there and say their entire sex life and justify the clothing that they were wearing, and that can no longer happen. Unfortunately, there's a lot of trying these cases in the press now because of that, but at least in the court of law, they can't bring up a defense that this victim is engaging in sexual activity with a lot of people or dressing in a very provocative way. That can't be done anymore. How about that in the UK system? I mean, it sounds like, I mean, it's outrageous.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good observation, Jim. Unfortunately, we had an incredible, one of my sheroes is called Harriet Harman, who did away with the nagging and shagging defense. That's what it was called, by the way. Not in law, but that was the shorthand that all the lawyers called it, the provocation defense. Now, unfortunately, it's been replaced with the loss of control defense. Well, she kind of forced me to do it. So we do still have a problem with that. And when we think about the sex game gone wrong defense, well, she consented. Do you remember when we talked about Natalie Connolly?
Sure.
And she had 40 plus injuries? You know, she consented to that. And as I said before, no woman consents to her murder. So there are some changes that have happened in law, but the domestic abuse bill presents another opportunity to really focus and tighten down on these areas where men are literally getting away with murder. And the other thing I just want to say, and I just want to read two cases, is that, as you both know, I spend a lot of time training, either in the classroom or here in my virtual classroom. And I've been brought into some of the areas where some of the most horrific cases have happened. I've been the fixer behind the scenes, i.e. when something goes wrong, I normally get the call to say, well, can you come in and train our police force? So when Daniel Pelker was murdered, I went into Coventry and retrained social services. When Essex had 12 murders of women who were murdered again by men who had histories, I was brought in to help restructure the force and help train their officers. And I've been doing that for many years. And what I understand now is that no amount of training will change these systemic failures.
That's
the problem.
That's just such a stunning thing to say.
Yeah, because I used to believe that training could. I used to be the believer that you can take people on a journey. It's the hearts and mind piece. And then as soon as I started to talk to people in classrooms about the cases, just as what I'm saying to you now, that they would move the needle in their attitude and their aptitude, and they would want to help. But unfortunately, that happens with some, but not all. And I think we have systemic failure. And I think it's much more about aptitude and attitude and accountability, i.e. there's no leader saying that you must do it. It's important. And if you don't do it, you'll lose your job. If someone dies, you'll lose your job.
It was July 2016. And despite multiple complaints of escalating incidents of stalking by her ex, 19-year-old Shana Grice was told her case was being dropped by Sussex Police. 1 month later, her stalker Michael Lane murdered her. He was sentenced to life imprisonment last year. But it wasn't just Lane's actions that were scrutinised, but those of Sussex Police too.
One question that's really bugging me, why did you take the key in the first place?
I wanted to see you, I've been talking to you, and I knew you wouldn't let me in otherwise.
Shana recorded a call to Lane, trying to prove she was being stalked. He had broken into her house and stood over her while she pretended to sleep.
Yeah, but that's not good because it's putting us in danger. You could have flipped at any point. What about
no,
if...
I wouldn't have flipped.
But police only charged him with the theft of the key. PC Mills was barred from ever working as a police officer again after failing to investigate that incident properly. Alongside him, four officers faced a misconduct hearing and one other for gross misconduct. Former PC Trevor Godfrey handled some of the earlier incidents between Shana and Lane. One where Lane had grabbed her phone from her ear after running after her, and another where Shana said he'd been lurking in an alley near her house late at night. But Mr. Godfrey recommended that no further action was required after texts undermined her version of events, which he said led him to believe the whole thing was a smokescreen to conceal an affair. Shana was later fined for wasting police time. After 2 days of gruelling to and fro and hours of deliberation, the panel found that although retired PC Godfrey had failed to be diligent in some aspects and to see Shana as a victim, that his actions did not amount to gross misconduct, but to misconduct. They added that their findings in no way meant that Shana Grice bore any responsibility for what happened.
You know, and then we also have another major problem, which is that police and agencies continue to see the incident, i.e. they attend the incident and they treat it like an isolated incident. They don't understand, even though I've stood in training rooms for 25 years saying it's a pattern of behaviour, that domestic violence is always a pattern of behaviour, the same with stalking. And why I brought the coercive control law in was to make clear in law it's a pattern of behaviour. So you must approach it that this isn't the first time, because we know when someone calls, there's been normally 33 things beforehand with DV. With stalking, it's 100. And I've been saying this for many years. I've trained thousands of trainers to be in classrooms saying exactly that. But yet when the 911, the 999 comes in, they attend the incident and they fail to join the dots about the perpetrator because they're so busy looking at the victim and saying, well, why doesn't she leave? Why doesn't she do that? Why did Deborah Newell do this? Why didn't she protect her children? And they're not seeing Dirty John. So my question is, what are you doing to make him stop?
When he was making the calls and leaving the voicemails, you know, I played the voicemails to the police. They didn't take that as evidence. All they said was, you need to get yourself a nice boyfriend.
He said that he was going to ruin her life, he was going to beat her up, he was going to throw acid in her face. Having shown that to the police, they said, well, there's nothing we can do about that.
I realised that the police, they just didn't take it seriously. They weren't monitoring the escalation in his behaviour because it went from lots of calls, text messages, emails, etc., Facebook, WhatsApp. And then he was leaving me voicemails saying 1 minute that he loved me, then the next minute he was pretending to kill himself.
After 6 months of constant stalking and unhappy with how the police treated her complaint, Zoe decided to meet up with her ex to try and reason with him. After a long chat, she allowed him to stay at hers but on the sofa. Unfortunately, that's when things took a turn for the worse.
I came up to bed and, you know, I went to sleep pretty much straight away, you know, like I was in bed. And then I was on this side of the bed and he literally kicked me and I flew over to the other side of the room. And then when I came round, I was slumped over this side of the bed here and he was over here chopping his wrists with a meat cleaver.
God. What were you thinking at that point? Like,
I need to stay alive.
Zoe was stabbed in the neck, had a bleed on the brain, a broken nose, lacerations on the chin and torso, severed tendons in her hand and a broken arm.
Zoe's case is just utterly horrific, and it's also ongoing because he'll most likely be released very soon. And I'm very concerned for Zoe and for her children, as well as for the next woman that he targets, as currently there's no duty to monitor or manage him. And that's what we want to ensure happens, so that Zoe, the risk to her is managed, but also the future victim that he starts a new relationship with, they must be protected too. And there are two more horrific cases I'd like to share with you. Holly Gazzard was stalked and murdered by Asher Maslin in Gloucestershire. Now, she was brutally killed by him in her hairdressing salon after she ended the relationship. And there had been coercive control pre-separation and then stalking post-separation. And she did report to the police. But unfortunately, they said there was nothing that they could do, despite the fact that he had stolen money from out of her account. He'd threatened to beat her and also to throw acid in her face. Now, if they had bothered to check the intelligence databases and his history, they would have found out that he was involved in 24 previous violent offences, including the three on Holly, but also there were 12 on former partners. And in fact, one former partner said that she was really worried that he would kill the next woman, and she was so desperate to get away from him, but she was really worried for other women and girls. And then there were three on his mother. In fact, his mother called the police saying that he would kill as well, which is incredibly rare when that happens. And there were four violent offences on other people. So why wasn't his violence and his violent offending behaviour joined up? And then there's the case of Justine Rees. Nicholas Allen coercively controlled and stalked Justine Rees. Now, Justine took her own life. She took herself out of it and she wrote in her note that she'd run out of fight.
Oh, jeez.
He desecrated her mother's grave. He threatened to kill her children when she went into a refuge, and he made her life utterly unbearable. That's what the judge said in his sum up. And he did, because this is a case that I've reviewed. Justine had reported Alan 34 times to Staffordshire Police. 16 of the allegations were not even cross-referenced. 7 of the police call-outs were not cross-checked at all. And it was only revealed in court that Alan had a string of convictions for violence against women and girls, including stalking. But yet, after Justine's death, Alan was convicted of stalking and coercive control, 6 counts of stalking, 4 of coercive control. Why wasn't he charged before she took her own life? And he was always also charged with manslaughter, with causing her death. That was the first time we've had a case where we've managed to do that. He was jailed for 10 years. He'll be out in a few. The next relationship he begins will be the same pattern. I can't tell you why Staffordshire Police did not join up those 33 call-outs, but I can tell you that that's what I see as a pattern that repeats across most police forces. And you'll remember we had Alice Ruggles' father on, Clive. We talked about Molly McLaren, you know, another case. And you remember this case vividly, Lisa, because you put on Facebook the video of him going to her gym.
Right.
Now, he had abused multiple other young girls. And in fact, one girl, Alexandra Dell, reported him to Staffordshire Police. Now, it's not about one police force, but there are some areas that crop up far too often. Now, Alexandra reported that he'd threatened to stab her and kill her, and he was stalking her. They did nothing. And despite the stalking law being in place that I campaigned for, that came into place in 2015, his history was not joined up. And Molly was left at risk, and that he had abuse multiple other young girls, and yet that was not joined up. The same with Alice, you'll recall, Tryman Harry Dillon, multiple young girls that he had stalked and abused. It was his pattern of behaviour that was not joined up. It's heartbreaking. And you heard from Clive the impact that it has on the families. And I've been talking to families for years, working with them, and they all support this campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody supports it who's been through it because they feel angry that their daughter wasn't told about the history. And some right. would say, if we knew and we should have been told, we would have taken a different course of action.
Right.
I can't tell you why people are choosing not to do it, but I do see that this is a systems failure. It's a people failure when they see it as an isolated incident. And there's no amount of training that will change this. We have to change it through law change, because it's only through setting that standard. You must. This is core business. This is a priority. It's going to be measured. Therefore, it will be done. We've got a performance framework, and it shouldn't just be reliant on the police, by the way. I have a lot of sympathy and empathy for police colleagues who have a huge amount put upon them by everybody, that they have to be all things to all people.
Right.
Every time there's a pilot that comes in, it's always the police that have to lead it. I know that from working within it, and police, majority of the time, are can-do culture. But what I'm saying here is that it shouldn't be police-led. There's actually three agencies responsible for perpetrators. And in the UK, it's prisons and probation service and police. And I'm saying those three authorities should come together, just as they do with sex offenders and terrorists, and problem solve these very dangerous and violent people.
I feel like I'm experiencing deja vu all over again, because what you're saying feels kind of like what your friend James Densley was saying about, you know, training police to, you know, to recognize their own unconscious bias, you know, their own racism. And, you know, he's saying that all this training he's done, and it's still so hard to root out that. And it kind of sounds the same thing. And the same thing protesters are saying, that police can't be all things to all people, that you need that social worker who will just on the ground and get in there.
You need the specialists. And you know what? These perpetrators are absolute masters at power and control and coercive control. And therefore, you've got to have professionals who are specialists who really get it. And I just want to give you one more example, and then maybe you can ask some questions about what people can do or any questions that I haven't been clear about.
Mm-hmm.
But here's another case. It's a recent one. And Joe Story stalked and murdered this beautiful young woman called Kerry McCauley. Now, Kerry had 19 injuries. He broke every bone in her face. And prior to that, she had reported him to police for beating her and threatening to kill her right before the murder. And he was arrested, and then he was bailed. Despite the fact he had convictions for assaults on women and serious assaults dating back to when he was 14 years of age, Kerry knew nothing about this, and she was left unprotected. Now, he had actually violently attacked five previous girlfriends dating back to 2008. He had three restraining orders on him to protect former partners. This case was clearly, and local professionals said, this case should have gone to the map. Why didn't it? Why didn't it go to the multi-agency public protection arrangement? And the clear answer to that is because there's no duty for it to. But what I heard the detective chief inspector say outside of court was this. And she effectively said it was a terrible case, but she said, we're going to do a domestic homicide review. And one of the questions, and by the way, that's a process I brought in to learn the lessons, but she said, one of the questions we want to answer is why she went back to him. I literally wanted to burn the house down again, because that's not why I brought domestic homicide review in as a process. It's not about focusing on what she did. It's about what he did. Right. And I can answer why she went back to him, because no motherfucker was doing anything to protect her. What choice did she have? Women say it's easier, safer to go back because at least it's not unpredictable. When they leave, when they separate, it's the most dangerous time for them. And she went back because nobody did anything, because she knew she was left unprotected. She tried to risk manage herself. And by the way, DCI, you should have looked at his history to know that he was a very serious and violent offender. And that if three women had restraining orders out on him, why weren't you protecting those women and Kerry and all the other women that he had attacked? He was a serious and credible risk and threat. And you're asking all the wrong questions. And that's what I see day in, day out. That's what I really want to change.
And you're sick of it. You're sick of all this fucking death going on that can be avoided. It's just...
Everybody should be sick of it.
Yeah.
It's nauseating. And it's not just nauseating, it haunts me. Yeah. You know, I wrote the piece in The Telegraph as a very, and it took me a while, because whilst I've been back in London, I've been going through all my 25-year case files, and it's brought a lot back to me, just how many cases I've worked. And in some way, I wanted to memorialise these incredible women who weren't believed, who were disrespected. And I couldn't save them because the cases never came to me before. But I did create a risk model, and I've been trying to change the culture. And I want to use their stories to move the needle and get this campaign over the line in every one of their names. And when I wrote that piece for The Telegraph, it took a lot from me, because it's the same story over and over and over again. And I'm fed up with asking nicely and asking people to do it because they don't want to do it. And for whatever reason, they don't think that women's lives are worth enough. They don't matter enough. And I want to use their names, their cases, so that they didn't die in vain. And I feel like I owe it to them. And The Telegraph piece was very raw from my heart.
Yeah.
Because when you're going through these cases, you know, there are mothers who were killed holding their babies or strangled as their babies were lying on their beds. There are children growing up without their mothers because a violent, entitled man felt that it was his choice to end her life. And that is unacceptable. And these men are currently not visible. And we must make them visible and we must make them accountable. And quite frankly, if people are against this, they are part of the problem. And that problem, we've got to change. It's a gender bias and it's misogyny. When will women's lives matter enough to make these changes?
Laura, it is so distressing, and I can hear the distress in your voice as you're talking about these cases and these women who were victimized and could have been saved. And obviously, the work that you're doing now and that you have been doing for decades now is incredibly important, and we're behind you 100%, and we want to help in any way we can. Obviously, once you're successful in the UK, we hope that we can bring that over to the United States and do the same thing here, because certainly we are a much bigger problem in terms of geography and the number of enforcement agencies that we have in this country and so forth, and the extreme politics that are involved in getting any legislation passed. But I hope that this episode helps get your word out and helps people understand the real severity of this problem and the need for change immediately. Hopefully they will get up and do what they have to do, get in touch with their lawmakers and make sure they understand that this is something that has to be done now.
And hopefully our listeners will pass this episode along to anyone they think needs to hear it. Just keep passing it and passing it along until people get Laura's message. Until there is public will, nothing will change. Until you add your voice to Laura's voice, nothing will change.
Exactly, Lisa. And that's the key thing. People are always, well, what are you doing, Laura? And I'm like, well, I'm working 24/7. I'm not really sleeping right now because I'm having to put briefings together and brief the media, brief MPs. And working these cases is haunting. And it's about what we can do. I can't do this on my own. Yeah. I need to do it as a collective. And I need to have other professionals and people stand up for the women who've been disrespected or lost their voices, because we can be the change that we want to see. And there has to be a momentum. So please do use your voice. And just to say, the cases I've read out, most of them are on my website, my Laura Richards website. And I've got various other things on there, including the article from The Telegraph, The Independent, The Guardian. But these are not isolated incidents, not on a micro level and not on a macro level. there are thousands of cases like this. And even with the petition, and you can still sign the petition, it's just under 180,000 people who have signed. That tells us that people want this to happen, is that lots of family members have written on their messages about their daughter, like Sam Laney being murdered, holding her five-month-old baby slashed and having her face ripped open. Jeez. And died. And her mother wrote on there, please make this happen. There are other survivors who have said, this happened to me, this happened to me. It's not just about one or two horrific cases. This is about a systemic set of failures. It's about institutional incompetence, and it is across the board. So you can write to your MP, your Member of Parliament. I'm posting infographics every day with please write to your MP, and you can find them at writetothem.com. And I've created a template that you can adapt and add your own details in, and that's on my Laura Richards website. And you can also submit written evidence to the Domestic Abuse Bill team. That Domestic Abuse Bill team will take evidence, written evidence, from anyone up until June the 25th. And that's when the committee stage will end and they will go into report stage. So please, if you're a professional, if you're a survivor with lived-in experience, if you're a family member, if you have knowledge and you want to change things, please write to the Domestic Abuse Bill team. And you'll find on my website, I will put up my template. And every day I will tweet and be posting infographics. But I've also, since May, the beginning of, been posting cases every day, cases where, and I keep saying, how many more until change happens? I really want this to happen because I know it is the right thing to happen. And it just cannot be allowed to continue, because all of these cases, and I will say it, and it's a bold statement, but they were preventable. And if they'd come to my unit, we would have done some very different things. And that's not to say we can save everybody, but women are being spectacularly failed every day, every day. And that part, for me, is unforgivable when you've got men with extensive histories of coercive control and stalking. I say very clearly that they were allowed to offend with impunity. And the action we take and work together as professionals to focus on the perpetrator, that's the cultural shift. That, again, just to underline, that we focus on what the perpetrator is doing, the same as we do with any other crime type, and we try and problem solve what's happening, but we stop blaming, shaming, and judging the victim, because it means that we take the offender out of the conversation. So this really does matter. And it really is something that we know, domestic abuse, rape and stalking doesn't happen in a vacuum. And these murders don't come out of the blue. And we have to stop routinely ignoring the perpetrators. So please be active. Please be an upstander and stand up for all the women who are no longer with us. We will post all of these things on our website and also in our show notes. Please go back and listen to the interview with Clive Ruggles and our discussions about Molly McLaren. And there are multiple cases that we've talked about with Zoe Dromfield, for example. Now, those who listen to Zoe, she was actually victim number 18. You know, no one in West Midlands decided to actually look at the history of Jason Smith. And that case is ongoing. So please go back and listen. And actually, all my training sessions, I use our podcasts. I don't know if you know this, Lisa and Jim, but I use those episodes and I run facilitated discussion sessions on our podcasts because these are learning tools and it shows the importance of what the three of us are doing. And I just want to thank you for giving me the platform, the time and the space to talk about this, because it's so important to me. And I just thank you for also lending your voices to this important subject and for being fantastic advocates. So thank you from the bottom of my heart for allowing this very special bonus episode to be put together. It really does mean a lot.
Well, we thank you. You're our Shiro. You know that. You're our Wonder Woman. And it's such a privilege to be on the show with you.
And it's an honor to help you do this important work.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I appreciate that. And to everybody else, no family should ever have to go through this. They should never have to go through what Clive and Sue have gone through because of Alice being brutally murdered. And they knew who did it immediately. So please listen to that heartbreaking episode. And I'm sure we're going to come back to this subject. So for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the exonerated five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233. Thank you.